mortgage capital markets decisions carry real financial consequences. That's why Optimal Blue commissioned an independent ROI study with MarketWise advisors, analyzing results across hundreds of lenders. The study highlights consistent gains in efficiency, accuracy, and financial performance, including an average $1,006 net benefit per loan. To be notified when the full 2026 Optimal Blue ROI study is released in May, sign up at optimalblue.com/2026-study.
Welcome to Optimal Insights, your weekly source for real-time rate data and expert capital markets commentary, brought to you by Optimal Blue. Let's dive in and help you maximize your profitability this week.
Welcome to Optimal Insights. I'm your host, Jim Glennon, Senior Vice President of Hedging and Trading Operations at Optimal Blue. Our clients and industry partners have long relied on Optimal Blue for trusted insights and commentary, and these podcasts are an evolution of our commitment to keeping the industry informed. Let's dive into today's episode. Welcome, everybody. Thanks, as always, for being here. We have a wonderful show for you today. Whether you are an originator, a capital markets person, or just someone interested in good mortgage industry information or just great market commentary, you're in the right place. We'll talk with James and Alex here in a minute. We'll do a little bit of a market update. And then after that, we had an interview with the brilliant Seaver, our CTO and fellow innovator at Optimal Blue. We'll talk a little bit about AI, machine learning, and may even have a surprise or two in there that we'll be able to show you here in a few minutes. But first, let's go check in with James and Alex and see what's going on in the market.
Good morning, everyone. You got Alex and James here coming at you live on this Monday, March 16th morning, St. Patrick's Day Eve. I see James is repping with a shamrock on the hat today. How you doing, James?
Yeah, pretty good. Happy St. Patrick's Day. You know, between that and Sinners kind of cleaning up at the Oscars last night, I was feeling some representation.
Yeah, nice. I saw, yeah, 0 for 9 for Marty Supreme, I saw, so.
Yeah, you know, it was a pretty solid movie. It's too bad he put his foot in his mouth.
Yeah, there were some good ones this year. I liked Begonia, personally. I actually have not seen Sinners, so I got to carve out some time to go see that.
Solid. It's solid. You'll enjoy. But
yeah, the Academy agrees with you. we'll jump right into it here with our econ update before cutting over to Jim and our CTO, Seaver, who are discussing the landscape of AI currently. But just looking at the economic front, as a recap for last week, we got a PCE number. This was before all the geopolitical developments that have taken place over the last 3 weeks, i.e. the Iran war. PCE came in for February around expectations, about 0.4% month over month. Remember, PCE is the Fed's preferred inflation metric. I misspoke. This PCE number was for January. I would have thought it was for February, but it's for January because of the few-day government shutdown that we saw at the beginning of the year. We saw that gasoline, energy prices, in addition to motor and vehicle parts, were the numbers that helped keep PCE this time around in check. That's something to definitely keep an eye on because I think we can expect in the coming releases, not the February release, but definitely the March PCE number, that energy cost will swing to the other side and act as an anchor to the upside for your inflation expectations. And then I think the other big number that we saw last week was in the GDP revision for Q4. That number initially came out at 1.5%, but was halved down to 0.7%. So we saw a smaller rate of growth in the economy to close out 2025, which on top of the geopolitical landscape, saw bond rates rise and equities sell off throughout last week. Taking a turn towards the DC circuit, there are two competing bills currently, one in the House, one in the Senate, that are of note to anyone in the housing industry. Right now, I believe it's the leading bill in contention is the ROAD, all caps, to Housing Act right here. They're just looking to expand the housing supply through a number of avenues. I think there's 40 plus different provisions attempting to get the housing supply into the hands of homeowners. Right now, the biggest point of contention is around institutional investors and how big of a share of the housing market they'll be allowed to hang on to. Right now, I think the biggest concern is around, for those that are considered large investors, those that hold 350 or more properties, they'll be required to sell those properties off over the course of, or within 7 years of acquiring them. Is that correct, James?
Yeah. And I think it's good to finally get a little clarity on this one. Trump had initially said he was going to sign an executive order, try and get this through. People were raising questions like, well, you know, no investment properties at all. You know, does that mean you can't have something that you're renting out, an Airbnb? Well, you have two houses, but you're not there. It's in Colorado or whatever. So you let people go skiing, rent it out at times. It is no, hey, this is for, and not just large investors, people who have 100 plus, this is super large, 350 houses plus. So I think from my perspective, I think that this makes sense. It's going to be difficult to get it through both the House and the Senate. This is definitely the sticking point, but it's something that, you know, people go back and forth on, well, there aren't really that many of these properties owned in the United States, but it is about 10% of housing is wrapped up by private equity firms or owners. That is on average. You can find places, Georgia, there's a couple cities that have 25, 26, 27% of the housing is owned. That's an enormous portion. That is, you know, they're definitely making an impact on who actually can and can't be a buyer there. So even if they were just frozen out, that would make an impact. Selling them will definitely make an impact. But then, you know, are they going to sell them at a little bit of a depressed price? Is it going to slow down if they're not allowed to buy? Well, will the housing builds in that area be at the same rates, or would it be slowed? So there's a lot of second order effects here, but I like the initiative.
Agreed. Yeah. The forced to sell within 7 years could, being forced to sell at that 7 year mark, who knows where the housing market could be at that juncture. And it could definitely create, like you said, some second order effects and actually depress a housing market, especially in some of these areas where they have a pretty big hand on the scale in regards to that local housing market, like you said, in maybe the Atlanta suburbs or North Carolina, throughout the Sun Belt, I know is where private equities snatched up the most homes. So we'll continue to see how that bill continues to evolve. It's got to go to the House. The House has one that they're also currently debating. I think the short of it, though, is that Trump has signaled that he was likely to veto anything that doesn't include some sort of provision around institutional investors. So we'll just have to see, you know, what the heads in Congress, when they put their heads together, what they're able to put together. Outside of that, like I mentioned, there's 40 plus provisions for increasing housing and getting more homes built, whether that's just making it easier to build, you know, slashing some of that red tape. I've seen definitely that some of the provisions are, you know, kind of encroaching more on historically what have been considered wetlands or river, you know, flood zones. And then in addition to that, just ADUs, accessory dwelling units, kind of the grandmother's house out back, in you know, common parlance, just being able to have a rental unit on your property that you own. So we'll keep an eye on that. I think that would have massive implications when it does pass. And it will pass in some form. This passed the Senate 89-10, I believe. So bipartisan approval across the board. In addition to that, on the political circuit, Friday kind of snuck under the radar. Trump signed two executive orders on Friday. One targeting affordable home construction, and the other was promoting access to mortgage credit. The affordable home construction, quite a bit of overlap with what's currently being debated in Congress. And then promoting access to mortgage credit, just much more so, they seem to be focused on getting smaller community banks into the lending space. And that was what that executive order was focused on.
First one there kind of leans into what you were saying, right? I was reading through that too, and it was, you know, hey, the EPA needs to relook at their rules around wetlands and whether or not you can build on them. So can we relax a little bit of regulation, red tape, and actually get building started quicker? The second, promoting access to mortgage credit, I think we're actually about to dip into. It's a little bit more of a deregulation move, right? It's kind of rolling back some of the Truth in Lending Act, trying to make it a little looser so that it's easier to get originations through.
Absolutely. Yep. That feeds perfectly into the next point that I want to talk about today, which is just bank deregulation. Michelle Bowman's kind of heading this up from the Federal Reserve Board. And this will be voted on this coming week with additional input still to come from focus groups and groups that have interest in this space. But the essentially what they're doing or what they're looking to do is have a rollback the capital requirements that banks must hold on different classes of assets back to 2019 levels. And this would all this would do is to expand the pool of capital that's available to be lent out. You know, Wall Street's been pushing to overturn post GFC regulations for years now, and several decades, really since they were put into place in the wake of the financial crisis. And as I said, this will only really pull back these regulations to levels that were in place pre-COVID. I mentioned a couple times here, but I think what's continuing to drive the market and all the headlines that you're seeing day to day just revolves around the war between the U.S., Israel, and Iran. And the Strait of Hormuz, where 20% of the world's oil and natural gas flows through. We've seen the price of a barrel of WTI crude, that's the sweet crude that is pumped here in the United States, that has increased by over 50% since the war began, from around $60 a barrel before the strikes began to north of $100 a barrel, settling around $95 a barrel at time of recording today. Seen a little bit of a give back there in the energy markets. You know, there doesn't seem to really be an end in sight to the conflict. And, you know, the main point of contention here being, at least for the markets, around the Strait of Hormuz and getting energy flowing again. I think that the main concern for you, you know, as a mortgage professional, is just keeping an eye on what this is going to do to push inflation expectations up. You know, we've seen before the strikes, we were expecting 2 rate cuts from the FOMC this year. And those have completely evaporated. We're expected to hold rates through 2026 where they currently are. And then, you know, just on the back of an expectation that the cost of energy will push inflation probably north of 3%. We've been in that 2.5 to 2.9 something range for 12 months now. Goldman Sachs sees each sustained $10 increase in cost per barrel, adding about 5 basis points to the core CPI reading. So where we currently are would probably add about 15 to 20 basis points to the CPI reading, which would push us to right around 3%, if not just above.
It's, you know, a little relationally to tariffs, that this would be more of a one-time shock, right? We would see the hit if it actually goes up $10 a barrel. So we're in the 90s, maybe even $100 a barrel for a long time here. That's the 5 basis points that you're seeing going to push us into 3% inflation. But at some point, this would hopefully all be resolved and you'd expect pricing to come back down. But there is, you know, the big threat is if things continue to escalate, if a lot of that, not just the strait stays closed, but a lot of the infrastructure to get the oil out of the ground or transport it at all is destroyed, that would be a longer term shock. It would be much more difficult to actually get everything moving again. And so that's really kind of the fear that's been stoked.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, solving the conflict is just step one to getting global energy markets back into balance. The next step is then for all these refineries and the pumping stations to be turned back on, which has weeks of lead time. And if this conflict continues to drag out, you know, that there could be second order effects to where different countries source their inputs for oil, which when a country is building out their energy infrastructure, they're targeting a certain, you know, grade of crude oil. You know, in the U.S., it's sulfur light, and the oil that's coming out of the ground in the Middle East typically has a higher sulfur concentration, which all the refineries that for these countries that buy this,
need to have specific equipment to work
yes.
with. You can't yep. just what's coming out of the ground in Venezuela and coming out of the ground over in Saudi Arabia or even the United States are not the same oil. And so you need different material and different equipment. So you can't just shop it around as easily.
Exactly. You know, we're not quite to that point yet in regards to the energy shock, but that could be, if this conflict were to become a years long conflict, we would see those kind of pain points arise. So just continue to keep an eye on geopolitics and see, you know, if it continues to escalate. It does seem to have tapered off at the moment. At least that's what the energy markets are saying as of this morning, but that is changing by the hour, by the minute. just looking forward towards this week. Again, I think geopolitics is going to continue to capture the headlines, but we will get a PPI reading. That'll be our last inflation reading for the month. The goods and services have been swapping off kind of month to month as to which one is creating inflationary pressures and which ones are seem to disinflationary. Right now, it's expected to come in right around where it's been at 0.3% month over month for the core, 2.9% year over year. Again, this will be a pre-Iran war reading as well. So I would expect it to fall near those expectations. Then finally, we have Powell's final FOMC meeting that will also be taking place this Wednesday. As we already touched upon, there's no expectation for a rate cut.
Yeah, and I think I like your note there because it's his last meeting, but Tillis is still blocking Warsh's nomination. So there's not a clear succession yet. Technically speaking, in prior years, this is not the first time in U.S. history that there was not an approved member to take the place of the Fed chair. Generally, what happens is the sitting chair remains in charge. It's not a written rule anywhere, so there will probably be some administrative pressure back in the news to try and figure out what exactly we're going to do here. Who, you know, does Powell actually get to stay and sit, or does it just fall to someone else? You know, is there a way to force Warsh through? So I would expect to see some headlines in the next couple of weeks coming back around to this, because the Fed is going to be critically important, especially now with inflation potentially back on the table due the oil shock.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think, yes, I think it's very pertinent to caveat that with an asterisk. It's his last official FOMC meeting. Yeah. There's a chance that he continues to carry on his duties beyond his, I believe it's May 15th. This is, again, asterisk final day. Yes. Yes. We'll continue to keep an eye on that. I know last week a judge kind of ruled in Powell's favor in regards to the ongoing criminal allegations in regards to the FOMC's redoing of the Eccles building and adjacent auxiliary campuses. But we'll continue to see, again, how the Trump administration's efforts to prosecute him continue to evolve over the next 2 months here.
Something to look forward to.
Something to look forward to. Perfect. I know that was a lot of information. We were blessed by the news this week in regards to content. But with all that being said, we will hand it over here to Jim and Seaver, who are walking through some AI and how we're using it here at Optimal Blue and in the mortgage industry. Thanks, James.
Thank you.
All right. Welcome, Seaver. Seaver is Optimal Blue's CTO and longtime friend and coworker of mine. Welcome, Seaver. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Jim. Good to be here.
We wanted to have Seaver on today. It's been a while. We talk tons about AI on this podcast, right? It's you can't go anywhere in the industry, even in the world, without hearing or talking about AI. We've had some of our own experts on the podcast. We've had third parties come on to talk. And of course, you hear, you know, Alex, James, and I, Kevin, go off on tangents about AI almost every week. But I wanted to bring you back in, Seaver, just to kind of level set us. It feels like we're in the very early stages of AI implementation across the world, certainly in the U.S., certainly in the mortgage industry, but it feels like we're seeing some benefits from it at this point. Well, like, where do you feel like we're seeing the biggest and most immediate benefits of AI in the industry, but also, you know, inside of Optimal Blue?
Yeah, for sure, Jim. And it's actually, you mentioned that you talk about AI all the time. One of my team members, during the Optimal Blue Summit last week, they counted the number of times AI was mentioned. AI and Gen AI during all the conversations and the speeches, not just from Optimal Blue employees, but also from all of our guest speakers, the panels. It was something like 624. And it was just like the most mentioned word, more than any other sort of unique individual word in the entire summit. So it was pretty interesting. But I think when it comes to the utilization of AI, I do want to differentiate between, and we've talked about this last time, right, between Gen AI and AI. And I know we'll touch on this a little bit more, but specific to generative AI, which, as we know, is used for completions, for language processing, et cetera, there's really different layers where it's being utilized. Obviously, in productivity, as you know, where we are and many in the industry or some in the industry are using it for productivity, whether that is just employee efficiency, if you're using things like Office 365 Copilot, or what is more complex in sort of coding tools, coding, testing, I mean, software coding, right, development. So that's really one layer where you see some of the organizations talk about how they're using generative AI in code assistant. The other one is really in the products, right, in the workflow. How do you help your customers, the mortgage lenders, the partners, the brokers, in their workflow and in their processes by deploying what we're calling AI assistants or AI agents? And these are Gen AI agents that go in. And as you know, we have so far deployed more than 12 of those, like the profitability assistant, the position assistant, obviously the Ask OB agent, the originator assistant. All those are features or products that we have delivered in the market that help customers with their individual processes and workflows. Originator Assistant, for example, helps the loan officers find better rates for their customers or the borrower. So to answer your question in really one sentence, it's kind of being used in multiple layers. The most that you hear about is in coding, in software development. And I think we're seeing more and more companies like us implement generative AI as agents to help our customers, the lenders, the brokers, do their work more efficiently.
Right. So on one hand, you've got, you know, we hear it from some of the software companies already, even though there might be a little bit of noise around whether they're laying people off to right size or to try to, you know, utilize AI just to become more productive, which is what I believe we've done at OB, which is to just be able to move faster, right, by having these AI tools help us code, but we're also deploying then tools for our customers, like you said, which
that's exactly right. And, you know, as far as, I mean, what a lot of people talk about sort of layoffs and unemployment rates related to Gen AI, specific to sort of what we're doing, at least in the industry or for Optimal Blue, we have started utilizing generative AI in our software development process. And this was done more than a year and a half ago. Right? I mean, we started it. You probably hear like every week something new comes out, right? There's new releases. There's a race. There's definitely competition between OpenAI, Anthropic, and you know, Claude. Now we have Croc. So these are all trying to improve their LLMs for specific use cases, not just for coding. So there is a lot of new advancement that comes out every week. But for us, where we have implemented it, and we continue to implement is how do we increase our capacity? How do we increase our development capacity so we can deliver more for our customers, deliver them faster? As you know, Jim, we have a product roadmap that goes for at least a year, year and a half. That is what is already laid out. And the vision and the ideas go even beyond that. So my thought is always, how can we deliver not only on that, we're working on our Q1 and Q2 roadmap today, but can I get our development organization in a position where we can start thinking about working on Q3 items? And we can do that by increasing capacity. And as you know, we can't just go hire 20 people and have them be effective day one. But if we're able to utilize AI to help us increase our capacity, even by 10%, by 5%, that really helps us with our customers. So that's really what we're focusing on, is how do we help increase capacity and quality at the same time, because you can use Gen AI not only in coding, but also obviously in the testing process. It can help you test better, find more issues faster before anybody else finds it. So that's really our focus from a software development lifecycle perspective, is increasing capacity while maintaining quality, but also increasing quality.
Right. We've called it the capacity explosion, right? There's a few components to it, but it's largely driven by AI and just our ability to get features done quicker, which to me has always been kind of the more optimistic side of what happens with AI. It's not to be able to do the same amount of work with less people. It's to be able to do tons more work with the same amount of people, which is how we're employing it today.
That's exactly right. That's really capacity with the same amount of people, right? So it's not, it doesn't replace the job, because you still need that, you know, you hear about human in the loop, right? You hear about, you know, especially when you have senior architects or senior developers, I don't want any code going to production without my developers looking at it, right? Because what we do in financial engineering is really critical for our customers. So I'm not, we're not any near the point where we're going to trust AI to build code for us, do code reviews, test the code, test the product, and deploy it to production. I don't see that happening for another 2 years, especially in our industry, or at least our Optimal Blue, because accuracy, as you know, is very important to us. That's really important to our customers. So when we deal with pricing, product and pricing, or hedging, MBS pricing, trading, we can't have any errors. So that accuracy is critical for us. So we're not going to have code written by AI be deployed by AI with nobody in the loop.
Right. And presumably that's going on throughout our industry and throughout the world, just in the way that it's being deployed, the way AI is being deployed. And it makes sense. You can't have the same group of people develop code, deploy the code, and test the code, right? You always need a second or third set of eyes. In this case, it would be the set of eyes of a human before code is actually deployed to production, because there can be mistakes. I see AI hallucinate more than it gets the answer right in some applications.
Absolutely.
If we're inventing new technology, the last thing we want to do is let it automate itself and potentially cause problems.
Yeah, 100%. I mean, we have senior architects using, for example, Claude Sonnet, right? And they use it for one problem or one project. It works perfect. The next one, it doesn't, right? They know, because they're looking at the code. And that's where, you know, I trust my development organization a lot more than I trust AI. But we are using Gen AI to assist us get a little faster, right? There's some work that you can actually have, like unit test writing, stuff that you can have AI built and write for you, but it doesn't really replace my organization.
It does some of the heavy lifting, the manufacturing of code, if you will, but it's still supervised. And that's, you know, that leads us to something else I wanted to touch on, which is related to AI. It's a specific application of it, I guess, is how I think about it, which is machine learning. And in our industry, there's a lot of different areas that you could envision deploying machine learning. There's several areas where we have already done that. So to me, machine learning is, it can relate to AI, I think, because it can learn. It learns from new information, but it generally is for applications where you're looking to chew through tons and tons of data to look for whether it's trends or anomalies, mistakes, or even the ability to project what may happen in the future, whether it's you're trying to project volume for your organization as a mortgage lender, or interest rates in order to decide what, you know, interest rate policy or even actual market conditions might look like. Do I have it right there? First of all, like, is that generally what machine learning is used for, and how we would think about
yeah,
it?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, machine learning is artificial intelligence, right? I mean, that's really one of the core pillars of artificial intelligence. And all of these LLMs that you hear about, which is the foundation of generative AI, the LLMs are machine learning models, right? They're actually built, trained using machine learning techniques and algorithms to build these LLMs, which are static models deployed. So, I mean, you hear about GPT 4.1, GPT 5. What that is really it's a trained model using machine learning neural networks based on, I think GPT 5 has 1.2 trillion parameters. Some of the smaller ones has, like, you know, 16 billion parameters, and that's considered small, you know, SLMs. So these trillions of parameters go into this neural network machine learning algorithm to build a model, right? And that model is your large language model, or the LLM, which is really a static model that is used and deployed. And that's what we all use. You know, Sonnet is one of them, obviously GPT, et cetera. But machine learning itself is exactly what you said, right? It could be predictive, it could be classification, or you feed it a lot of data, a ton of data, and you build a model that becomes sort of like an engine. And that model becomes a process where you can feed it data and gives you data, you input with some information and it gives you an output. So for example, if you build a predictive model for, let's say, bulk bit pricing model, so you can feed it a ton of data to train it based on historical information of how do investors bid on loans, and then that becomes your model. And then at runtime or when you want to use it, you say, okay, here's a scenario that I have, produce what the expected value would be or the expected bid price would be. That's an example of predictive modeling or regression analysis. And there's different, obviously, types of regression analysis, linear or nonlinear. But there's also non-regression models, non-predictive models, you know, some classification where you feed it a ton of data, and that's really what comes with LLMs. LLMs is both predictive and classifications, because you give it all this data and it recognizes and it tokenizes all that information based on the, like I said, trillion parameters that go into the LLM, but also then builds a predictive model that would predict what you're going to say next or what comes out of next. So when you are giving it your text to summarize for you, for example, it has the ability to do that based on all of the information that was fed to the model. We've been utilizing machine learning, but recently sort of formally established our own machine learning organization, as you know, to work on how we can take advantage and utilize the data that we have within Optimal Blue. Because as you know, we have a lot of information, we have a lot of data that we can use to build proprietary predictive models that help our customers.
Fantastic. Yeah, it's super fascinating. You know, you use the example of bulk bid prediction. That's something that we've actually done for years here at Optimal Blue. In case folks aren't familiar, if they don't work with us on the hedging and trading side of the business, we've been able to very accurately predict what bids look like for live bids on mortgage loans. So you could see how with anything, with sports, like predicting sports winners, predicting the weather, like a lot of these models are being trained to, again, suck down all this historical data, look at what may have changed, whether it's in the market or in the weather and manufacturing or whatever your area of business is, and predict future outcomes, which to me is just fascinating, where normally it would take a human or a group of humans or actuaries to compile all this information, try to determine statistically significant trends, and then somehow get it right every time. In terms of their math and their predictions.
That's really the beauty of machine learning, is it is a pillar of AI, and it's proven. Because when you build a model, you always come out with a margin of error. You know that there's multiple metrics that you use for a machine learning model, like R square or mean squared error, but you have a number, right? You know that the accuracy of this is, let's say, 98%, and you have a margin of error of 2%. But the more data you feed it, right, the more comprehensive the data, meaning that you have different data sets or differences in that data, the more accurate and more predictive your model is going to be, right? Because you're not going to overfit it. You're not going to feed it the same information, and it's always going to say, yes, that is correct, because it's the same data. The thing about machine learning is you can really rely on, and obviously in financial engineering models, you know, there's people rely on it. Netflix is an example where it predicts what you want to watch next. And most of the time it is accurate, right? It is not always accurate because there's a margin of error, right? There's a, you know, whether it's a 2%, 3%, 4% error rate, but it is published with these LLMs, with these machine learning models, right? Say, okay, this is, the confidence score is 95% or 98%. So you know what you're expecting out of it.
Right. Less accurate when there's a human component to it, like my own preferences of what to watch on Netflix, but probably a higher percentage for things like reading documents or maybe predicting volume. So yeah, I want to tease a little something here, something that we unveiled at the summit. So many people got to see it. It's not yet in the hands of clients, but we have a full working model of it. It is a machine learning AI assistant. We call it the Virtual Economist, and it's exactly that. I think it's very well named. And I want to see if we could pull it up on the screen here and ask it some questions. So this is an AI, presumably large language model AI feature that also implements and uses machine learning to make all sorts of predictions based on data that it can go out and find instantaneously, right? We talk a lot on this podcast about what's going on in the economy and how it might affect rates going forward, or how it has affected rates this week. We've talked a lot about like the conflict in Iran, for instance, and how that might change what's happening right now in the economy. And you know, frankly, Alex and James and others do tons of research online, listening to podcasts, reading articles, sometimes using things like Copilot to go out and find good information. But this AI assistant basically goes out and does all of that for you. Just if you ask it a simple question in plain English, which I just thought is just one of these kind of perfect applications early on for AI and machine right. learnings.
I mean, this is where we married AI and generative AI, because it has at the top layer, it has the generative AI where we do use the LLM. We didn't build the LLM. These are obviously, you know, the GPT models that we use in this case. But it does use that for natural language processing, for speech recognition. But also, you can ask, and you'll pull it up, right? We have an avatar. Those avatars are also generative AI built. And you speak with the avatar, and it's able to process the information using generative AI, right? Using the LLMs in the back end. But it's also able to respond to questions based on that. But the beauty is, the foundation of its knowledge is machine learning models that we built. There are four models currently that we built, in addition to the OBMMI data that we have also fed to it. So those four models are proprietary models that we built to for interest rate prediction, as well as rate lock prediction based on Optimal Blue's data. And that's where we kind of combine Gen AI and machine learning, which is also AI, into one application that is this virtual economist.
Right. So it can use data from everywhere, from out on the web, where we may ask it for current events. Then it can internally pull from our Optimal Blue data. So down the road, you would be able to ask it questions, not only on like publicly available data and trends, but also tie that back to your own pipeline within your own business.
That's right.
Cool. Okay. Let's go ask the virtual economist a couple questions, shall we? Let's start with something a little more involved. How about we ask it how projections could change if we see some changes in Fed policy? So we'll ask, what are mortgage volume projections if the Fed cuts six times in 2026?
If the Federal Reserve cuts rates six times in 2026, mortgage lock volume is projected to experience mostly positive growth compared to the previous year. The volume increases range from about 3% to over 15% for most months in the first half of the year, with some months in the later part of 2026 showing declines of around 12 to 15%. Overall, there is a notable increase in mortgage lock volume, especially early to mid-year, reflecting potentially stronger mortgage activity driven by lower rates.
Cool. Very interesting. All right, so that's obviously taking from some of our internal data and making projections based on also some market data that's available to the economist out there. How about we go microphone here? We'll ask it maybe what are some possible effects on the economy stemming from the war in Iran?
The war in Iran could have several significant effects on the economy, both regionally and globally. One, oil prices and energy markets. Iran is a major oil producer, so conflict could disrupt supply, leading to higher global oil prices. This can increase energy costs worldwide, contributing to inflation and higher transportation and manufacturing expenses. Two, inflationary pressures. Higher energy prices often ripple through the economy, raising costs for goods and services, which can push overall inflation upward. Three, trade disruptions. The Strait of Hormuz near Iran is a key oil transit route. Conflict may threaten shipping lanes, impacting global trade and causing supply chain bottlenecks. Four, market volatility and uncertainty. Geopolitical conflicts add risk and uncertainty, often causing volatility in financial markets as investors seek safer assets. Five, impact on economic growth. Higher inflation and market uncertainty can reduce consumer confidence, investment, and spending, potentially slowing economic growth. 6. Regional economic instability. Neighboring countries may experience economic disruptions from refugee flows, security spending, and trade interruptions. 7. Policy responses. Central banks may need to adjust monetary policy in response to inflation or growth slowdowns caused by the conflict. Overall, the war in Iran could heighten economic uncertainty, exacerbate inflation, and disrupt trade and energy markets, with potential global ramifications.
That is just wild. It would have taken quite a bit of research to come to some of those bullet points. All right, what should we do here?
Thank you. I'm here to analyze a wide range of economic factors and synthesize complex information quickly. Geopolitical events like a war in Iran have multifaceted economic impacts, and understanding them helps anticipate market and policy responses. If you have more questions about specific economic effects or need further detail on any topic, just let me know.
Let's ask the economist one more question here. Let's find out what its thoughts are on the incoming
Fed chair. As of early 2026, the incoming Federal Reserve chairperson's approach will likely shape monetary policy based on their economic philosophy and priorities. While I don't have personal opinions, I can share insights based on typical scenarios. 1. Policy direction. If the new chair favors inflation targeting and price stability, we could see continued vigilance on inflation with cautious rate adjustments. Alternatively, if growth and employment are prioritized, policy might be more accommodative. 2. Communication style. The new chair's transparency and communication strategy could influence market expectations and financial stability. 3. Balance of risks. The chairperson's assessment of risks like inflation, unemployment, financial stability, and global economic conditions will guide policy decisions. 4. Flexibility. The future Fed might adopt more flexible or data-driven approaches to monetary policy, adjusting more quickly to economic changes. 5. Innovation and inclusion. There may be more emphasis on economic equity, financial innovation, or climate-related risks in policy frameworks. In sum, Fed policy going forward depends heavily on the chairperson's priorities and the evolving economic environment. Markets and analysts will closely watch their statements and initial decisions for clues on the Fed's future path. If you provide the chairperson's name or background, I can provide a more tailored analysis.
Very cool. What are your projections for the OBMMI for the rest of 2026?
The current OBMMI, Optimal Blue Market Mortgage Index, for 30-year fixed conforming mortgage is about 6.06% as of early March 2026. For the rest of the year, projections suggest that mortgage rates will remain relatively steady, hovering around 6%. Slight fluctuations are forecasted, with rates dipping a bit below 6% towards the end of the year in December, near 5.99%. Overall, expect mortgage rates in 2026 to be stable in the mid 6% range without major spikes or drops.
Great. Very insightful. Well, wonderful. Thanks again, Virtual Economist. Thanks again, Seaver. Talk again soon. All right, let's wrap this thing up. Thank you so much, Alex and James, for the market update. And Seaver, wonderful interview. Thanks again for doing that. We'll talk to you again here real soon. And that's it for today. Join us next week for another episode of Optimal Insights, where we'll continue to provide you with the latest market analysis and insights to help you stay ahead. Check out our full videos on YouTube. You can also find each episode on all major podcast platforms. Thanks again for tuning in to Optimal Insights.